There is no Buddhist God per se. It is the self, the individual mind that contains immortality and ultimate truth.
What the hell is not religious about that? You've simply replaced God with the original self.
Yes, but we've localized it. At least we know where the self is. It's in our own minds. It's a form of human energy. Emily's quite content to go on with this life. She insists she's in love with me, whatever that is. If I don't strip myself of all this clatter and clutter and ridiculous ritual, I shall go out of my fucking mind.
She's still crazy about him. He's still crazy.
What happens during these blackout periods is you get the feeling of phenomenal acceleration, like you're being shot out over millions, billions of years. Time simply obliterates. Well, I want to break through that blackout barrier. I obviously regressed to some quasi-simian creature.
What we saw tonight was a physical phenomenon, an inexplicable physical phenomenon.
I was never real to him. Nothing in the human condition was ever real to him.
You saved me. You redeemed me from the pit I was in it, Emily.
Defy it, Eddie. You made it real. You can make it unreal. If you love me, Eddie, defy it!
Altered States is kind of several different movies, I guess. On the surface, it's a mad scientist movie, and you said, Ben, he described it as a modern Jekyll and Hyde.
Yeah, that was Chayefsky's pitch, apparently, when he first met Ken Russell about the project, was that it was a modern Jekyll and Hyde,
but,
which is, kind of true.
Yeah, like one sequence, but I think overall it's about so much more, and I think in a strange way it's also... Yeah, it's about transformation and a scientist who goes into an isolation tank and takes hallucinogenic drugs in a search for truth, but finds love.
Yeah, it's about as unusual you can get for being a horror movie, if it really even is one, depending on how you look at it. But yeah, I think it's, in a lot of ways for me, it's kind of a love story.
Hello and welcome back to Scream Addicts. I'm Jinx, your host, and our guests for this episode are Ben Collins and Luke Piotrowski. Mr. Collins and Piotrowski are screenwriters known for the VHS spinoff Siren and the upcoming Super Dark Times. Gentlemen, thanks so much for being on the show. Would you mind terribly introducing yourselves for the listening audience?
Thanks for having us, by the way. This is Ben speaking.
And this is Luke speaking. And yeah, we're super excited to be here, and not to pull the curtain back too much, but it's our first podcast, and we listen to a lot of them. And so, yeah, we've had some movies made, but I'm really excited to be on a podcast, honestly.
Yeah, it's, talking about something we like. And this, Jinx, you had us pick, which movie, and it was a long decision process, but this is what we decided on. So we're happy to be here.
I was going to ask, out of any horror movie you might have chosen, given the option to choose any at all, why did you choose Altered States? What made each of you sort of land on that one?
Well, I think the biggest thing is that we are writing partners, and so we are, in each other's minds quite a bit, but we have distinct tastes, and there's a Venn diagram. Mm-hmm. And as soon as you brought the idea up to us, we sort of had to look at that Venn diagram and think, well, there are movies that I love and there are movies that Ben loves, but we had to find one that we both loved. And there was a list of some, but this one seemed to be just I don't know if you came up with it separately, mm-hmm. but it was one of the first ones that popped into my head that I knew we both had great affection for maybe slightly different reasons even.
Well, that's it. I think that also starts to go into the specifics of my answer to that too, is that it's a movie that more so in, okay, I'm getting ahead of myself. Okay, some of my favorite movies are the ones that you really grow with over time, because the movie doesn't change, but you change as a person, right? And it's like the kind of movie that after years of rewatching it with gaps or many, many times in a row, depending on how you do it, you start to see it differently. And I think Altered States is a movie that I feel like for both of us, we saw it at a fairly young age, reasonably, and it's gotten more complex and interesting and richer to me as I've gotten older, and kind of continues to. So it's one that we have in common, but it's one that we also have in common in the sense that we've spent a while with it and are still kind of unlocking aspects of it.
Sure, yeah. No, every time I watch it, I sort of have forgotten how much I like it.
Oh, yeah.
And an interesting sort of, not to get too personal, but sort of the first time I saw it was when my wife, who was not my wife and not even my girlfriend yet, came to visit me, and she stayed at a hotel, and I went over there, and Altered States was on, and I'd never seen it before, and we watched this movie on the bed together, you know, and 5 minutes in we have like the nine-eyed goat that's like getting slaughtered and you know, she
was really romantic.
Yeah, well, it was because she like fell asleep on my arm and I didn't want to move because it's like, well, I'm just going to sit here and let my arm fall asleep. So it was like, it's tied up in this moment in my life that is also formative and important. And it's a strange movie for that.
Mm-hmm.
I can't decide if it is the best date movie ever or the worst, given the subject matter and that one reading of it could be that it is a love story. Maybe it would make for a great date movie. But on the other hand, wow.
Yeah. On the other hand, yeah.
I mean, to counterbalance that, I first saw it while I was recovering from wisdom tooth surgery in
Holy
college.
Shit.
I either borrowed it from you or from Kevin. I'm not sure. Like, it's only a couple of our friends had it. It was one of those movies that some people just owned, even if they didn't watch it, you know? And it was like, I knew I was going to go be on a bunch of painkillers and kind of be wacky, and I think I borrowed it. I can't remember which of you it was from. Was there like, oh, I should like get something weird, you know, like just kind of as a joke, but I also like, well, I've got to do something while I'm zonked out on pain medicine. So I watched it that way, and we'll go more into that later. But yeah, so we both have sort of very formative memories of our first time seeing it.
Yeah.
And then as we've gotten older and then now in our career, it's a reference point for sure.
It's funny that you mentioned that this was a movie that you watched when you had your wisdom teeth out, because I just realized that I had a wisdom tooth removal movie myself. When you're kind of hopped up and you're in pain, and yeah, literally the day that I had my wisdom teeth out, I think I was 17. It was a Tuesday, and David Lynch's Lost Highway and David Cronenberg's Crash had just hit VHS. I was dying to see both because they didn't hit any of the theaters around the small town that I was living in, and so I was hopped up on painkillers. I had ice packs on either side of my head. I was sipping in a milkshake because, you know, when you have your wisdom teeth out, it's pretty much milkshakes and soup from there on out for a couple of days. And while in that weird state, I watched Lost Highway and Crash, and I think I don't know that I would recommend any other way to watch those movies for the first time.
Well, the first time I watched Lost Highway, which was just recently, was on an airplane with people sitting beside me, and I had to stop because there's too many loud noises and sex scenes for me to be sitting next to strangers.
Yeah, but no, it's like weird movies like that kind of deserve a weird experience. And a lot of times my favorite movies are those kind of movies. And Lost Highway is another one that's a huge, huge, huge favorite of mine. So that's, and Crash is one, actually. I've grown to like that one quite a bit. But yeah, no, the wisdom teeth thing, it's a good time to let something in.
Milkshakes and soup and sex and car crashes.
Yeah, yeah, all of that. It's great.
What else is there? I mean,
really, when you boil down. Yeah.
Well, I'm sure Dr. Jessup would have something to say.
So can I ask, before we dive into Altered States, given that the two of you were talking about Venn diagramming your way towards that choice, if you had chosen a movie by yourselves, what would be your pick? Not necessarily your favorite movie, but just a single horror movie you would love to chat about at length.
Can I guess what yours would be, Luke?
Sure.
Would it be Freddy 3?
I certainly would love to talk about Freddy 3. Yes. So that quite possibly, you know, one of the things, but it's with Freddy, you guys have already done 4 with Jackson Stewart, right?
Yes.
And
yeah.
I think somebody talked about 5 as well.
No, not yet. I don't think anybody,
nobody's that crazy.
I can do this show for years and I'm pretty certain no one is going to choose Nightmare 5. I might be wrong about that.
Good. Well, somebody did the first one. Yeah, I just listened to that episode, which is also a really good episode. No, that's definitely one of my favorites. I think the other reason we wanted to choose Altered States, or at least on my end, was to do one that wasn't going to be quite so obvious. I could talk about Nightmare 3 all day, but I just sort of feel like somebody else will do that. So I felt this weird responsibility of like, let's do one that isn't. Yeah, because even scanning through to sort of look at older episodes, I was, do I want to listen to somebody talk about, you know, say The Shining, you know, which is mm-hmm. like, well, I kind of know The
Everything
Shining.
Yeah.
So what's going to be something that's a little bit more interesting to talk about. So possibly Nightmare 3. But I was also pushing for In the Company of Wolves.
Which I was open to, but I had less ammunition on.
Sure.
But that's a really good one, though.
It's a whole kettle of fish to open, but yeah.
Yeah, I don't know what I would – I mean – what do you think I would have done?
I would guess maybe Cure.
Cure would have been one. The Kiyoshi Kurosawa film Cure would have been, like Dead Ringers, maybe. I don't know. Something like that.
Just maybe even further afield of horror than Altered States is. But I think if we're going to call The Fly horror, I think we can certainly call Altered States horror.
So. Oh, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, it is funny that you mentioned that. Because the movie does seem to be, I mean, when you break Altered States down, I mean, it's the story of a scientist who's driven by his work, who meets a woman that falls in love with him, and they're ultimately torn apart by his work, and then his body is subjected to strange changes. And honestly, if you add tiny little wings and a Howard Shore score, I mean, Altered States becomes The Fly.
No, yeah. No, for sure. I think
they're around the same time period too, like within a couple years of each other.
Yeah, The Fly was a little bit later, right?
Was this it was 80,
and Fly was what 86
maybe.
86.
The Fly was more successful. It's deeper, though, which is interesting.
What's interesting about them was I think both of them, in terms of the relationship and then the role that the horror plays in the movie, what's kind of interesting is, yeah, you're totally right. I almost look at The Fly. I always looked at The Fly as like an AIDS allegory, in that you have this, you know, hip young scientist living in this place, and he falls in love with this woman, and then he starts to sort of waste away from this disease, and this is a woman that he's, you know, their relationship is rocky, but now he's sort of dying in this place, and you have this sort of disease metaphor of becoming the caretaker for this person and having to watch this person that you've entered a relationship with suffer through something that is degenerative, and it's like sad, and it was sort of right at that time. And so I feel like that there's a strong sort of, you know, sort of metaphor emotionally there. Whereas with Altered States, I think it's the same thing, but much more of an addiction story. You have him ultimately turning into an ape and running around naked through the city, and it's like that's his bender, you know. Mm-hmm. that's when he regresses and loses control, and it's like, well, shit, you know, is this guy ever going to get his shit together? And you sort of, again, the relationship of following this woman, and she has to watch this man go through something that is destroying him, but it's just from a slightly different angle. This is something, in both cases they're doing it to themselves, but I think with Jessup as opposed to Brundle, it's something he's continuing to do to himself on purpose. Whereas there's something accidentally that Seth Brundle stumbled into, whereas Jessup is continuing to harm himself again and again.
Which is interesting, because it's funny because it seems like maybe The Fly was just better timed for its own specific metaphor. Because, The Fly was a bigger deal, I think. And like it seems like this is maybe a little bit muddy in terms of like people don't necessarily watch this and see exactly what you're talking about.
Right.
Which is maybe just because there's also this crazy imagery and stuff like that that sort of distracts you from the central metaphor. But I think your thesis is actually really correct. And I don't usually think of it that way. So I find that really interesting.
Yeah, and I don't know. I mean, I don't think that's like their agenda, but I think it is an interesting... it's one of the things that makes this movie interesting to me.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, and I could totally see that it is sort of a story about addiction, I think. But it is funny that you mentioned that Chayefsky essentially saw it as being a Jekyll and Hyde story. And I don't think I initially saw that. But now that you mention that, I mean, it totally is. But that is really, really very interesting. But at the same time, it makes me wonder, too, like, I think when I watched The Fly, I definitely get the feeling by the end of it that it is a love story. I mean, there is definitely a romance at the core of it. And I mean, it's a doomed romance, but I mean, it's still absolutely a love story. When I watch Altered States, and it is funny that you mentioned that you know, we do grow with certain movies. I'd only watched Altered States once before when I was a teenager, and I really enjoyed it. But revisiting it for this chat, I realized much more so than I did when I was a teen that there is much more going on with this movie than it being a simple body horror tale. But, you know, when I got to the end of it, I had to ask myself, and I'll pose a question to you two as well, do you think the movie is sort of this body horror tale that asks some big, interesting questions and then sort of cops out with a, you know, kind of a love conquers all ending? Or do you think it was a love story from, you know, minute one?
Well, I'll let Ben talk first on this. And this is in part to answer that, but also to carry on the idea of addiction. That we have Jessup, who's clearly addicted to truth, and she calls him a Faust freak, and he's addicted to the, you know, the drug and the experience and all that stuff. What's funny is that she's also addicted to him, And she continues to come back to this guy who is as destructive for her and her life as the drug and the tank are destructive to him and his life. So all the characters have a sort of addiction. It's just, what are you addicted to?
And she does have that amazing final scene near the very end, her big monologue to Bob Balaban's character about how she can't get him. I think she might even use the phrase, she can't get him out of her system, you know, so.
Yeah. And I guess, yeah, I mean, to me, when I was watching it again the other day for, I mean, I couldn't even tell you how many times I've seen this movie, you know, it's been in the past couple of years especially, but I was watching it, you know, in prep for this and looking at it, and it's kind of crazy, like, structurally, it you know, you start with the image of him in the vertical tank, which they sort of dispense with really quickly, but it's just such a strong image, and, you know, it's certainly... At the time, I don't know if people were really knew what the hell that was. I mean, people now still don't really know what the hell it is. But so you have this very distinct image that doesn't tell us what the movie's going to be, but at least we know we're in for something interesting. And then we're like seeing the characters and they're talking all the science stuff that we don't really know what it is, but the, you know, they're fun and cool, you know, seeming guys. But pretty quickly in like the third scene, he meets Blair Brown at the party. And it's like the chemistry and the stuff, like it really, like that becomes what the movie, like that's what you're watching at that point, is William Hurt and Blair Brown, like kind of having this moment together and falling in love. And then the next time we see them, they're, you know, they're casual and they're talking about going to hook up at her place. And then it's this like sex scene that's like, you know, this intimacy with them. Well, you know,
like, cut to that sex scene.
Yeah. Oh God. It's like sweaty face, like hanging over the camera. It's like, it's so good. But then it's like, you know, immediately like they have this whole post-coital, like they're both nude, like sitting in the thing, like talking about their childhoods and stuff like that. And it's like, this is well before, if you know, the horror elements have even been presented to us. Like, we don't know that going to the tank is going to do crazy shit to him or his body or that his, you know, it's like all we're doing at that point is like, it's more like a Woody, like a late or like a mid period Woody Allen movie or something like that. And so to me, watching it this time, especially, I was like realizing that, oh no, the movie is setting itself up to be about them as people. And then all the stuff that happens to me is kind of like complications that get thrown in their way as the couple. And that by the end, it does seem somewhat harmonious for us to sort of end with them kind of reuniting. Now, I mean, it is very much a Hollywood ending.
Well, I want to talk about that, too, yeah. In terms of sort of the love conquers all idea. Because to me, one of my favorite shows just ended was The Leftovers. And I think that show has sort of an arc and a moral of – and this does as well. This idea of like positing religion and religious questions – and characters that are not religious but dealing with the sorts of things that religion deals with. And ultimately, to me, it's not just that love conquers all. I sort of get the read, and I think the book plays this – hits it a little bit harder – is that there's a rejection of truth in favor of happiness, and that there's also this correlation between, you know, ritual. Like, Jessup's like – he's complaining about his family and how he just can't stand doing this stuff. And he calls it all senseless ritual. And then he goes into this cave and takes mushrooms with a bunch of shaman and has a spiritual quest. And that's really funny. But he wants this stuff. He wants these answers so bad, and he wants this truth. And ultimately he finds out, well, there is no truth. There is no answer that's going to be satisfactory. Any attempt to give life meaning is a type of ritual. And he ultimately rejects his quest for truth and realizes, okay, you know, what does matter is staying with this woman and raising my children. And I don't need to ask these questions. I need to be present here. And I basically need to choose this truth as opposed to this cosmic truth, because in the end, it all doesn't really mean anything. So sort of finding faith in the acceptance of faith and acceptance rather than belief, I think. So it's sort of finding love and letting that be the truth and just being satisfied with that.
I gotcha. I you know, they do end on that final line with him finally saying, I love you. And I believe that is the first and only time he actually says it. In fact, Emily makes a point early on, doesn't she, that, you know, I forget what he says. He goes about essentially accepting her marriage proposal in a very practical way. And
that's as close as a declaration of love I'm likely to get from you.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, of course, you know, it does end with him finally saying, I love you. So I guess in a way it could be read as a love story. I guess, you know, in watching the movie.
He's an irredeemable asshole. I mean, like, I don't want it to sound like this is some like a love story in the sense of like, well, this is the love we should all aspire to, and poor, you know, Emily has to put up with so much shit. Like, you know, I'm sure a lot of women do in relationships. Like, oh, this is my great mission to do this thing, and choosing to be in the supportive role, and you know, she's clearly sort of the hero of the piece that is representing, you know, human values. It's no mistake, I guess, that he is that way, and he is presented to be sort of unlikable, and he has to learn what's important.
I do have to wonder, though, because like everything you hear about Paddy is just that he was this impossible, like, you know, this sure. just this difficult guy, and I have Ken Russell's autobiography open in front of me, which I purchased specifically to read the section about Altered States. So I am a big Ken Russell fan in general, but I really was specifically wanting to read about that. And all of the butting heads between the two of him and Patty just being a total, like, dominating just prick. It makes you wonder if, like, I mean, you know, rest in peace. I mean, that guy's a fucking genius. Like, I mean, that's all you're getting out of this. And it's like, did he... You wonder
is he presenting Jessup as a hero of... That does he
know that? Because if he's that way, you know, as a person, you know, you always wonder that. Is, you know, like, do assholes know that they're assholes? Do bad people know that they're bad people? You know, like, does the head of some oil company, when he watches, like, you know, some 80s movie,
I would think that except himself, ultimately, you know? The Emily's paradigm does win out, and that the final order of the movie is him coming down to her level of, you know, getting his head out of the clouds and getting and actually saying the words "I love you."
Sure,
is
sure.
sort of like her paradigm has succeeded and won over his.
Mm-hmm. I guess I'd be curious. What's something I don't know the answer to is whether or not he did have like addiction problems or something. Like, I would be curious to know how much of the Jessup traits come from any kind of experience, or is he just, you know, a good
but either
writer?
Way, I think that is something that gives the movie juice and makes it feel very unsafe. Is the fact that the guy who is ostensibly our hero clearly does not share our values and our morality. So from page one, he's even in the book, he's sort of hitting it harder of just like, yeah, I could marry you. I won't be a good father. I won't ever really be able to love you like you want. I could pretend and maybe that'll be okay. And he's like kind of lays it all on the table and it's like, well, Jesus, you know, and if this is our hero, what's the morality of the movie? You know, well, what is the...
We were saying the other day that Mason is the only reasonable character
in
the whole thing. And when you meet him, he's like drunk. He's the drunkest one at the Italian restaurant or whatever. So you think he's like just like their sloppy big, you know, friend. And later on in the movie, he's the one being like, "You guys are fucking ridiculous. This is outrageous." And you're like, "Yeah, somebody's got to say that." Like, you know, because she's just enabling him the whole time. "Oh, you want to go off to Mexico? Cool." You know, and it's like he's the one that's like, "This is dangerous. This is unsafe." And it's like, yeah, I mean, Bob Balaban's totally on for the ride. Like, nobody's stopping this guy. Like, it's definitely you know, it gets out of control because. Yeah,
well, I love Mason. Mason's the sort of the badass skeptic.
He's the heart of the piece.
Yeah,
I wish I don't know what it would be, but I want a Mason Parrish movie. I want a movie where he just walks into frame and out of frame, just shouting and trying to make sense, but not bothering to finish any point. You know, he's just fury and anger, and then eventually he becomes the cop from Nightbreed. But
yeah. Yeah, so often the naysayer in these movies is the biggest frustration for me of whenever there's a character that refuses to buy into the conceit that made me buy my ticket, like, there's not vampires, you guys are being ridiculous. And I usually hate those characters, but there's something about the way he handles himself and just his sort of skeptical stance that to me is empowering as a skeptic myself and just like he makes it fun. He's not stopping the plot from happening. He's bringing this energy to it that, you know, screaming that monologue of his credentials to Jessup in the hallway.
And he's totally like, he could be the entry point in the movie, I think. I mean, I think there's almost another telling of this story where he might be the lead, you know?
Well, yeah, I was actually reading one of the things that I found interesting that I didn't have time to prep for this is that apparently, like, Chayefsky had just won his Oscar for a movie, I believe, called The Hospital. So, like, it was apparently, like, you know, like he'd done Network and then he did The Hospital. And I believe that they were both sort of, like, satires of those institutions or something. And so it was, like, a huge hit movie and he'd won the Oscar. And then this was obviously, like, he wrote the book first and then immediately set it up with Warner Brothers or whatever and did the Altered States, the movie. But that it was sort of, like, a hot project because Paddy Chayefsky doing like medical related drama was just an Oscar winner. So it was like this weird movie that like, again, has like very little precedent among genre or dramatic movies. This like if he hadn't won the Oscar for The Hospital, it probably wouldn't have happened. And like your instinct there, Jinx, to say like, oh, I wish I could just watch a whole movie with that guy. It's like, well, that I'm curious if that's not what The Hospital is. You know what I mean? It's not like a hard hitting yelling at like an Aaron Sorkin medical drama or something like that. Cause like, that was how I was equating him. It seems to me like Paddy was sort of like the Aaron Sorkin of his time. And that like, if you can imagine like, you know, like Aaron Sorkin probably had a really easy time setting up another political thing after West Wing, you know, right. it's like he was in his zone at this point, but then, you know, use that cred to make it the weirdest fucking movie. This is like a studio movie. It's like a big budget studio
movie. Well, do the list of directors who who passed before it landed with Ken Russell.
This is amazing. This is from Ken Russell's book. I just read this to Luke before we started. So this is from a scene in the book where Ken Russell's agent has called to tell him that he got the job to direct Altered States. And Ken Russell's like, oh, great. And he's like, sorry for the bad news. And he's like, what bad news? You just told me I got a job. And he's like, yeah, but you know you weren't their first choice. And he's like, oh, so what? I was like in the top five or something? And he's like, no, not at all. And this is the list of directors that they went to that passed on the project before Ken Russell accepted it. Steven Spielberg, Stanley Kubrick, Sidney Pollack, Robert Weiss, Orson Welles, Martin Scorsese, Fred Zimmerman, Woody Allen, Ingmar Bergman, Brian De Palma, Bernardo Bertolucci, John Borman, Andrei Tarkovsky, Irvin Kershner, Francis Coppola, Roman Polanski, Richard Lester, Michael Winner, Sidney Lumet, George Lucas, Nicholas Roeg, John Schlesinger, Francois Truffaut, Franco Zeffirelli, Brian Forbes, and then he cuts him off, and I don't even think Arthur Penn's listening there. Arthur Penn left the project because Chayefsky was such an asshole. And so, like, that's the whole reason they hired Ken Russell, who, according to the rest of this chapter, was the 27th choice to direct the movie. because it was this hot property, and they, like, you know, it was burning a hole in their pocket. Like, they were already spending money on development. Arthur Penn had hired VFX supervisors and stuff. Like, Arthur Penn was, like, in prep on the movie. And then he quit because Chayefsky was being so impossible, and Warner Brothers was just like, if you can get somebody to direct this fucking thing, we'll just do it or whatever. So like that was, Ken Russell was in a pinch after all those people said no. And it's like,
which is insane because he's
perfect for it.
It is the perfect deployment of his particular set of skills. In that I could watch these dream sequences all day and all the sort of compositing and layering. It's like, like Houssou or something. All these abstract things, just sort of talking to Ben beforehand of like, I appreciate that stuff, and that could be its own movie. Like, and so often the sort of surreality and artistry is just in service of itself, or in a way in service of nothing, just for the sort of experience. But I love that craziness can be in this particular project in service of narrative, and that we build these sequels, these sequences, and they're part of the story, and they're built in, and they strengthen the Woody Allen movie of it all, or, you know, the horror movie of it all. And it's like, well, that's like all that Ken Russell juice. Like, this is the perfect movie for him to do.
Well, I wonder if it was probably his highest budget, because, you know, he was doing all that trippy stuff in like his British films. But
sure.
I wonder if this was, he's just really, I mean, I was even reading that this was one of the first films to use what is effectively like CG. Like, this was like an early use of computer generated imagery in some of the digital rotoscoping of their bodies at the end and stuff. And so it's like,
I was going to ask, would it be like the weird TV static almost effect on Jessup at the end?
I think it is. And it's like, that's pretty crazy. You know, like they were definitely like breaking boundaries with stuff.
Sure.
And it's like, you know, really, really Ken Russell getting to, you know,
to
play with
unleash.
Crazy stuff.
Yeah. Ken Russell Unleashed was the note that I wrote down.
I am glad that it landed with Russell, but I got to admit, out of that entire list that you just read, I have to wonder what Nicholas Roeg's Altered States would be like.
Oh, I can't even imagine. Yeah, that would be particularly great, because he would have had just as much. He would have loved like the messy adult relationship aspect of it just as much, and then like the sexuality. Like, it's definitely, I think he's.
Well, I hit upon the Spielberg thing, and just, you know, as I was noticing, which is a thing in 70s movies, and Chud to less effect does this as well. But just looking at the three leads, the male leads anyway, when they're all sort of hanging out together, and it's like, it's totally Jaws. Like, these are the Jaws guys hanging out and yelling at each other and disagreeing about how to handle the situation, and it has that sort of textured quality that feels almost Spielbergian sometimes.
Well, then I was comparing it to Close Encounters, which it's kind of like, a weird inverse of, which you're saying.
Right, yeah. If you look at sort of Close Encounters, where you have, like, Dreyfus is, like, this good family man, and then these aliens come, and he's intrigued by this mystery, hops on the UFO and flies away, leaving his family behind in favor of the mystery, whereas we have Jessup, who is the inverse, which is, oh, I'm all about this mystery, and ultimately realizes, man, I could just fucking go down this rabbit hole forever. It is infinity. I've seen infinity. Fuck it. Let me come back to my wife and tell her I love her. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
So they're kind of on alternate trajectories.
And yeah, and like the opposite of what you would think that particular filmmaker would do.
Sure.
Like, because I've always thought that Close Encounters was, like, in retrospect, like, weirdly dark for a Spielberg movie. You know, like, it's like when you think about it in comparison to how weird and fucked up this movie is, that it ends with, like, the love conquers all, quote unquote, thing, and Spielberg's, like, story of mystery and wonder and aliens excitement ends with, like, a father abandoning his family. It's so fucking weird. Yeah.
But you mentioned Jaws, and now I just imagine Balaban's Arthur and Charles Hayes Mason sort of, like, comparing scars over the isolation tank while Jessup's inside. I would pay to see that movie. Just that scene.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned that, though, the ending and Jessup sort of realizing, you know, the whole I've seen infinity thing, and then that ultimately leads him to, you know, the arms of his wife at the end. And I wonder, like, and again, this sounds like I'm going to knock the movie, and I'm not, because I actually really, really, really love the film, but I've only seen it twice. And on the second viewing, I never really felt that moment where Jessup has that turn. I know there is dialogue sort of supporting that and leading him to that moment, but did you ever feel like you got the moment where he changed as a person that leads us to the ending that we ultimately get? Or did I miss it entirely?
That's an interesting question.
No, I think that's a totally fair criticism. And it structurally it is sort of like, well, he does come down and say I love you, but it is only after he's sort of bullied everybody and achieved what he wanted to achieve. Let me get back in that tank and let me go in there and let me see the mm-hmm. stuff. And, you know, it doesn't
feel like there's any sacrifice on his end to get to the place that he ultimately does. I mean, unless you sure. want to count, like, you know, changing into that primordial sort of mass. I mean, I guess that's punishment enough, but. You know, I if you look at Cronenberg's filmography and then you look at what happens with Jessup, he almost gets off the hook a little too easily. Just the fact that he can reconstitute and, you know.
No, exactly. Yeah, he doesn't turn into, like, some Akira fucking thing at the end. Like, he actually does become a person. But yeah, I guess, tell me if I'm wrong here, guys, but, like, I kind of, in some ways it's like, because it's basically like they, all the crazy shit happens in the tank and then she pulls him out. And it's sort of supposed to be like that's the end, like, oh, you killed you killed Jason or whatever, and then they go back to the apartment, and then it's like he has the last, like, the aftershock that's already, it's like he's already, like, whatever you wanted, you got, but you've now it's inside you, and you don't need to be in the tank anymore, and that's like your ankle getting grabbed by the, you know,
yeah,
and
yeah.
So that if there is the moment that you're talking about, it's somewhere in there that, like.
Well, there is a moment
that he's in the last thing that, like, no, this is now you've gone over the edge. It's going to take you. You have to fight your way back out of it. And this is the thing you're fighting for. I don't know.
Like, yeah, no, I agree. It should be stronger. And I agree a different filmmaker would probably have been able to make that land a little bit more. And even a different writer. You know, the end of the book, it is all very, very close. And it's actually whatever Chayefsky's, you know, hang-ups were. It is a very faithful adaptation. But reading it in the book, he rejects his research, and even though they've got all the findings, he wants to burn it. He wants to destroy the research.
Oh, interesting.
And basically get rid of it. So when they're at the house together, it is like, I'm done. And she's like, okay, come back. And I guess his moment of sacrifice is he's like, I think I'm too in it now. I don't think I can ever come back. But I want to destroy the stuff. I don't deserve to be with you. And then the change starts to happen.
I wonder if it would be a stronger film for that ending.
Sure, yeah, and I think that's the intention of the movie, but it's sort of getting breezed over in that he doesn't feel like he can come back to them. He starts to change, and she helps talk him down, sort of mm-hmm. like, again, he's like a heroin addict coming down. She's sort of there to help him, and when he's having his take on me video moment in the hallway, slamming into the wall, is her sort of like, she's pulling him back out and tethering him back, and so... And then when he says, I love you, it's sort of like, okay, we're going to try. And you're the only thing that can sort of keep me there. But obviously that's us doing the work that maybe the movie should have done more of. But
yeah. This is a funny anecdote. Maybe that first time I watched the movie when I was on like codeine or whatever they gave me after my wisdom teeth thing, I thought my memory was that I finished the movie, but for like about 5 years, I thought it ended with the ape thing. I thought he turned into the ape and then somehow he reconstituted as a person. That was the end of the movie. And so when people, for like 5 years, when people would ask me if it came up in conversation, I'd be like, yeah, it's a really cool movie. Like, Hallucination is really cool. Like, I really love the style and stuff. It's like, the ape thing's kind of silly at the end. Like, that just, you know, kind of petered out at the end. And then, like, I think it was in 2000 and, when would that have been? Like, maybe 2009 or 10 is, I think, when I came back to it. And my wife and I watched it together, and I think I even prefaced it like that with her. I was like, yeah, it's a pretty cool movie. There's cool stuff in here.
Then he turns into a monkey.
Yeah, yeah. And but then somehow I'd forgotten that whole last section. And that was when the movie became like, it's in like my top 30 favorite films of all time. And it flaws and all, I love it so much. But like, we both were like, holy shit. And I was like, wow, how did I forget that? So it's like, it was a good enough. I would have given it a B+ when I thought it ended with the monkey thing. But, you know, it bumps it a letter grade. But yeah, like all that stuff, you know, to me was sort of like bonus dessert. And just like, because I love that imagery so, so, so much. And
well, that scene with him as a primate, it almost does feel like a big climactic sequence. It feels like, you know, it almost feels like the end of American Werewolf or something with him rampaging around.
Oh, yeah, there are shots. Yeah, I noticed that. Yeah, they're like... even some of the way they shoot it, like when he's chasing the custodian, mm-hmm. and he's like, you can see him catching up behind him. But it's even like that sort of above shot, like when you see the in the tube when you see the werewolf sort of coming out. That is the sequence that it is kind of most full on horror movie. If they're like hiding his face for a long time, mm-hmm. and he's leaping around in the shadows.
It's a little silly still. I mean, it's just it's like classic. Like at this point, it's hard not to see like a. You know, like a experimental dance troupe.
Oh, sure, yeah. I was like, who is this gymnast that they've hired swing from the fire escape?
Because that also, it's like, you know, it's reminiscent of 2001, which that, you know, that was that sure. what that was. And also, I mean, that's another connecting point. I consider this in 2001 and Enter the Void to be something of like a triptych film.
Oh, wow.
And I think, it's interesting. I was thinking about it. It's interesting to me that there even is the ape stuff, because that is, you know, there's no literal connection to 2001, but that's, you know, both with the trippy, you know, cosmic stuff and with ape stuff. I guess Enter the Void doesn't have ape stuff, but...
but it should.
I mean, well, supposedly, I've heard from a reliable source that Gaspar Noé wanted to remake Altered States for many years.
Oh, wow.
But if he did it, he wouldn't... And this was a quote given to me. He wouldn't do all the monkey shit.
Well, but that's the most supremely satisfying time in Jessup's life was squatting at the watering hole and eating a sheep in the zoo.
Yeah, I mean, I have no idea. I mean, look, if Gaspar Noé wants to remake this movie, I say I'll go for it. I don't know how you do it without the monkey stuff, because it does seem like a progression. But
I do wonder though if that, you know, now that you mentioned that he said that, looking back at the movie, so far as Jessup's, I don't know, regression through time, I wonder if that scene with him as sort of the primate character, I wonder if that isn't a bit redundant considering that he already experienced it once, you know, and we only experience it through his, you know, sort of narrating the entire thing. But, you know, almost beat for beat, I mean, he sees them, he is then a part of them, and then it ends with him eating an animal, and then they open up the tank and he has blood on his mouth, and God knows where that came from. I'm kind of very happy that the movie...
That's a good point, and that's actually a really effective scene, and something that I made note of as well, of how creepy it is when you have, you know, Mason's like pacing around the tank and you just have this sort of sedate narration from Jessup describing what's happening to him, and it's this hypnotic, upsetting kind of sequence when you're not seeing anything. It's just, he's just that tank and that voice is coming mm-hmm. out.
Yeah, it's weird. Yeah, if you just did that sequence and then advanced from there and didn't actually have him physically come out of the tank and run amok in the Bronx Zoo or whatever that is.
Right.
I wonder if you could lift that entire sequence out of the film, if it would create any issues or if it would actually just flow much better then.
Yeah, because you would still be able to have his, like, the one of the best...
The body horror.
Yeah, the shower scene when he like it's all that weird, like the bubbling up of his arms and like his feet get opposable thumbs and stuff. Like you would still do that. You just wouldn't, because that's a precursor to him leaping out and dancing around and screaming and, you know, all the stuff that he does.
Oh, sure. Yeah. And that's so effective. And his facial his reaction to what's happening to him is what makes it even more upsetting, is how
he's just
getting a kick out of the fact that his body is regressing and deteriorating. And just the lack of care for his physical well-being or his detachment from his body and the physical world is so chilling. If you look at his face when they're looking at the x-rays, he's like looking like his newborn daughter has like just arrived. Like the look of like beatific like love on his face is very upsetting.
I think he probably shows those x-rays a bit more affection than he does his own children, who I think we see them for what, 30 seconds in the entire film, maybe?
And he sort of turns to her and is like, yeah, everyone thinks your dad's going crazy. I haven't seen her in a year.
Is that not Drew Barrymore? Yeah, I think this is Drew Barrymore's first movie, by the way.
Yeah.
Really?
Pretty sure, yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. It's a weird, interesting. No. Yeah. I mean, it also, it's that thing, though, that we've talked about before, that it kind of went away in the 80s, and it's come back now to some degree. But in the 70s in particular, like, horror movies all were about adults. And there's something scarier on some level of seeing, like, you know, like, William Hurt's, like, 30 or something in this. And, like, he looks like a man. And he acts like an adult. Like, if you're a teenager or a kid watching this movie, like, they look like your parents and stuff like that. But it's, like, seeing them make such horrible choices and put themselves in such terrible danger and stuff. I mean, it's the same. It's, like, you know, like, seeing a helpless adult or a frightened adult or somebody that should be responsible being irresponsible. I do think that even if it's older than your average horror movie audience member, I think it impacts just as much, if not more, than this sort of teenagers getting killed by slashers.
Sure.
And stuff.
I mean, his dismissal of his children is a pill to swallow that could be off-putting. I mean, I've already, you know, I don't like him as a character. I don't like him as a human being. It's all, you know, sort of their relationship is incredibly problematic, but I love the movie and I love, you know, the sequences and sort of the metaphors of it. And it's supremely interesting, but I could see how somebody watching the movie could see just the fact that the children are included, but just so dismissed by the parents, just being like, man, fuck this movie. Like, these people are awful. And I can see it being a turnoff.
I think that's more of us as adults in responding. Cause that was the whole realization we had was when, like, cause we've been, you know, trying to write horror movies for a long time and we've seen trends go up and down. And, you know, when the Blumhouse movies started getting big and like Sinister was one of the first ones I remember seeing, it's like, oh, it's like adult Ethan Hawke. And he's like making bad choices and he's putting himself and his family in dangerous situations. And that was unsettling. And now, of course, the Conjuring movies are fucking huge. And it's the same thing. They're adults. They're actual adults. And like, it's always like, you know, the Warrens are the adults that come in because other adults called them. And there's always children in the mix somewhere.
Sure.
But I think that it's emotionally compelling in a weird way. And it's, for a long time, horror movies didn't seem to do that or didn't realize the importance of that. But like, you know, I think it enhances the scares. I mean, The Exorcist, Rosemary's Baby, The Shining, you know, all the classics from that era, that's the late 70s, early 80s era,
sure,
are movies about adults, even if they're kids.
But The Exorcist and The Shining, obviously, the children are characters with agency.
True.
They're not props. They're having their own sort of emotional journeys, which Jessup and Emily's kids are. Go back to Ben, sweetie.
I've got an undergrad to fuck. Go, leave me alone, kids. I'm just like the casual, like just drifting in and out of being married or divorced, or just like this very 70s acceptance of like looseness or so. I don't know. It's so weird, but maybe I wonder if it was normal. Like I said, did Patty just think this is how people live their lives? I don't know.
Yeah.
It does treat it very casually too. I mean, the way they never make a big deal about him being in bed with the, you know, his student, and much in the same way that at the end, when again Emily has her her big monologue, you know, she mentions, you know, there having been, you know, many other lovers that, you know, never quite, you know, made her forget her husband. So, but again, it's just sort of casually tossed off, and it's, I don't know, it's yet another kind of fascinating window into that particular relationship, I think.
Well, and that's the stuff that reminds me of a Woody Allen movie. I feel like when you look at like the sort of like late 70s, early to mid 80s Woody Allen movies, that's always the plot. It's like, oh, this couple, they're happy, but they don't It's not like it used to be, and oh, maybe they should try other people, and oh, she finds somebody great, but he turns out not to be, and he has a bunch of flings, but then ultimately wants to be with his wife again, because he's... It's always like that kind of a story. That's the narrative of a lot of those movies, and they're always professors, and they're always like upper to, you know, wealthy, well, but it's never about that. And that's exactly what this is.
It's certainly a 70s thing, you know, but you could also sort of read into it in that, again, the movie kind of exists in the morality and the focus of Jessup and what he values, and he's casual about it. Like, I did, there's the great scene in the book and the movie where Arthur's Bob Balaban like finds out that they're getting a divorce, and they're like at the house, and everything seems normal, and they're just like, man, what a, like, why is this place so messy? And his wife comes in and is like, they're getting a divorce, you know? And it's like, what? Why? Huh? And it's, you know, and then he tries to talk to Jess about it, and he's like, yeah, no, we're getting a divorce. Like, I just can't, like, if I do this anymore, I'm going to go insane. So I'm going to go and do some drugs down in Mexico or whatever. And then, like, he's so casual about it, and the movie kind of just, okay, like, I get it. Like, we're following this dude, and he doesn't value that yet.
I really wish Chayefsky had written something along the lines of, like, Bob and Carol and Ted and Ape Man. You know, I think he could have mined a lot of really interesting stuff out of that, but...
That's pretty good.
I'm sorry. I can't help but be sometimes.
No, I'm into it. I got to ask that Luke, we haven't talked that much. And Jinx, I don't like hijack the conversation here, but we did. It's worth mentioning. I don't know if you've got other notes you want to do, but you did try the tank the other day.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
So in prep for this, I had done it a couple times before.
That's how excited I was to be on your show. Yeah. Like, well, I'm gonna read this book.
Okay, whoa. Wait a second. You, in preparation for this little podcast of ours, got into a – I hope all of the previous guests are listening to this.
Realizing
that maybe rewatching a movie or reading a couple of chapters in a book isn't going to work anymore. You guys have sort of raised the bar for any other Screamatics guest from here on out.
Got to step it up, man. You know, you got to go stalk somebody if you're going to do a slasher movie just to see what it's like.
I drew the line at doing the whatever the hallucinogenic is.
Ayahuasca. But so tell me about your experience. I did it twice a year ago when we were researching another project, and then I did it on Friday just because I was thinking about this podcast and I had nothing to do that day, and I was like, well, hell, I've been meaning to do that again. So I did, and I was telling Luke, and he was like, well, shit, I should just do that. Like, yeah, finally, this is the reason to do it. Because you've been interested for a while.
Sure. Right? Oh, yeah, yeah. I have been interested for a while, and this is sort of the thing that pushed me over the edge. It's like, okay, well, now I have a deadline to do it by. I mean, I don't want to bum anybody out. I'm obviously the Mason of the group, you know. So it was like, I enjoyed it, and I would like to do it again. I you know, there's some mild colors appeared. You know, I was trying to sort of get into it, but I think I'm just so wrapped up in my own head that I had a hard time cutting loose in the way that I should. So a second round should go.
Doing it more times is one, and that's what they even.
But it's scary, you know.
It's weird. It's really weird.
Mine was dark. It looked somewhat like the coffin style that Jessup's in the basement. It didn't have a slanting door. It had a totally vertical door, but it was just kind of like a giant refrigerator. And she opens the door for me, and it is just a black coffin, you know, by 10 by 10 sort of coffin. And you just, okay, I guess I'm going to go in here and close the door for 75 minutes. So, but I got over that pretty quickly. And
do you have like a panic button or a get me the hell out of here sort of knock that you can do?
You can, they sort of teach you to go in, and before you close the door, or sort of just like orient yourself to the space. I don't know if they said all this to you or not, Luke, but they tell you that like you close the door, and then they suggest that you like open it up so you can prove to yourself that you know where it is and that it's easily openable. Because it's not like a refrigerator door. It's like a little like hatch thing. Like,
yeah, it's easily.
So you if you do wake up into the thing, or you know, because you'll drift. I don't know if you had lost time, but like
feel like 75 minutes.
No, and it's like whether or not, you know, in some cases, it's hard to tell if you slept or not because there's no.
Yes.
It's like I might have slept or I might have just zoned out, and you might wake up and be like, where the fuck am I? And then you need to be able to know, like, sense memory wise to, like, oh, I can hit that thing open if I need to. But of course, it's better if you don't. You know, I think it's better to just float through the weirdness. And
Yeah, and you had sort of a more exciting experience.
I had a couple. I have a recurring hallucination. It's not, I mean, yeah. To our listeners out there in the world, these things are fairly readily available if you Google it.
You can do it yourself.
Yeah, I mean, they have them at like health spa type places and different, you know, there's definitely out there.
Stranger Things taught people how to create one in their local school gym.
It's true.
Yeah,
true,
exactly.
True.
Yeah. And, you know, we were a little bummed when we saw that in Stranger Things because we, you know, we were hoping that nobody else had picked up on this influence that we, you know, but, you know, that was inevitable. But no, I mean, it's not like altered states. I mean, maybe it could if you did actually take hallucinogenic drugs, which they all facilities tell you no substances. Because I think, I mean, they gained popularity after this movie, and I think there were a lot of people doing it. Although supposedly, like, and I don't even really know who this person is, supposedly Joe Rogan is like the big advocate for
this. Oh, sure.
That's where, like, on all, like, when you sign into these places, it's like, how'd you hear about us? Like, you know, blah, blah, blah. Joe Rogan is like one of the sources for how you might have heard about floating. I have no idea what that means. I don't know.
Is he the Fear Factor guy?
Yeah, he's a Fear Factor guy. He was on with News Radio.
He's an actor?
Yeah, he's an actor comedian.
Well, apparently he's really into
yeah,
to
he does some, like, podcasts and things.
So I think he probably, I've heard that he probably does do, like, drugs in them. Because he's, like, one of those dudes that's into,
well, that all sort of goes back to something, not to, like, redirect the conversation away from this, but just in terms of why this movie is appealing to me and why it's so scary to me, is that, like, two things that I have no experience with that frighten me are drugs and religion. And that seems to be what this movie is entirely about. So as far as a world that is off-putting and upsetting and how this imagery works, it's just trafficking in two things that I do not understand.
Well, you don't have, I mean, you were raised Catholic, but you don't have any residual left the Catholic imagery.
I mean, by raised Catholic, it's like there was a crucifix on the wall of my bedroom.
Sure. So you didn't gain any of that weird Catholic, like,
I did not. No, it's all... It's all another world. Yeah.
Well, see, because I wasn't raised Catholic either. I was definitely raised religious, so it resonates with me. But the imagery is so specifically Catholic, which is totally all Ken Russell. Apparently, I was reading in his book that, like, even though Chasky was like a total, you know, like, you know, stickler about the script, he was told Ken that, like, yeah, the hallucinations feel undercooked. Like, you know, work on those for me. Like, you know, basically asking him to come up with ideas for them visually. And because Ken Russell converted to Catholicism, I believe, in his, like, 30s or 40s or something, he had some sort of conversion experience. I don't know for sure, but it was after he already had, like, kids and stuff like that. He became a Catholic. And so that just naturally comes from him. And so I'm not sure if the character was written. You tell me, actually, in the book, was the character written to have been this religious?
He did have, at 9 years old, would have the religious vision. So all that story is the same. Again, it's the dialogue, you know, the monologue that he sort of gives about his father dying and how when he died, and, you know, his last words were terrible. that is what sort of killed religion for him, and the vision stopped, and it. So it's not necessarily Catholicism, but again, it's that idea of faith and that he had something.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, like, I just keep coming. There's a line, and she sort of hits on it, but I took a picture of the page in the book because I was sort of liked it so much. Is when Emily's sort of soliloquizing to him, and she says, "We're born screaming in doubt, we die suffocating in doubt, and human life consists of continually convincing ourselves we're alive. And one of the ways we do that is we love each other." And so that he had faith.
That's really good.
And that was shaken.
Mm-hmm.
And then he didn't have anything. And so he's trying to fill the vacuum with some kind of meaning. Like, well, I thought I believed all this religious stuff, but I guess my dad just says death is terrible and he was a good person. So I have to find a different truth. And that means regressing to all this cosmic shit. And Emily's sort of like, no, you don't. You just need to sort of – you loved your dad. You can love me. We the doubt's going to be there, and how do you shine a light in the darkness?
Well, actually...
Do you believe him, though, when he says that? When, you know, I mean, sure, we have the sort of visions, and we have early on him mentioning that he was thinking of God during sex and, like, crucifixion.
Oh, God.
And
run, Emily, run.
But
crucifixions.
But, you know, when he does note later on that he doesn't believe in God, but in the original sort of self, you know, contained within everyone, what is it, 6 billion years of memory and experience leading back to that self, you know, it does seem like Jessup is, I still think it seems like he is searching for God, even if he wouldn't necessarily find himself saying that very thing. It's almost like there's this resistance, I think, to embracing that religious side of himself, which very clearly haunts him throughout the movie. You know, he always has to appear to be, even to himself, a man of science. But I don't know. What do you guys think? Do you think he's honest in that, or is he deceiving himself?
To find religion or to replace religion. His quest is a religious quest.
It is very, when you put it in those terms, it really does sound like an Ingmar Bergman character, or even like Ingmar Bergman himself, which is funny that he was on that list, because that is totally like the resistance from what something that you sort of know is true on some level, but it clashes with like the parts of you that maybe you value or don't value or whatever, but like that you're conflicted in some way that, you know, if you could just let go of it, you would have. You know, and so obviously, like, you're right, like he's practicing some level of self-deception. You know, I think that's interesting, and I don't know if you're trying to switch to something else, but what's funny when you're talking about all that stuff, to sort of take it all the way back to the tank stuff, like, my experience in the tank is that anything hallucinatory or anything revelatory that happens in there is specifically because it's just you in there. And that was like, I did have an experience where I kind of like itemized my life in a for some reason, this is the second time I did it. And I found myself in there and I was like, all I got in here is just me. And I was like, so I'm just really going to, I'm going to look at me, you know? And I'm like, what am I? You know, I'm a husband and I'm a writer and I'm a friend of people. And, you know, what do I have that I love? You know, I've got a wife and I've got my cats and I've got a house that, you know, I have an apartment that suits my needs. It's like, you know, what do I want? You know? And like, it's like, do I want like a fancy car? No. Do I want like some enormous house on a mountain somewhere? No. Like, and I was like fighting and I was like sort of about like weighing what I did have against what I didn't have. And came to the conclusion that ultimately I had everything I needed and I was happy and I was satisfied.
Well, geez.
And it's like, no, and this is so, when I say like, it's sometimes cool things
happen.
You saw
the crack between the nothing or whatever.
Yeah, it was really, and I came out of it like totally refreshed. Like I kind of did, and it's funny because it's what you're talking about, the fundamental dissatisfaction of this character. It's like, it's ironic to me thinking about it now that he goes into the tank to find the answers beyond himself, like being like the universe and like the whole,
right.
Like, what is, you know, God and the, you know, this cosmic shit at the end. But that in reality, I think that what you're more likely to find if you were to go into the tank more is exactly what you were saying you didn't have, Luke, which is like a piece of your own mind and like a part of just like being there and comfortable with yourself. And that there is all there is. And that is like the byproduct that so far, the one positive byproduct that I have experienced from the times I've done it. Now, when I did it on Friday, that didn't happen. I was kind of hoping for like a sequel to that.
Yeah, yeah.
I was like, man, this would be great. I'm like totally like connect with my life again and stuff. And like, no, it was just kind of cool. Like, it was like, that one was just like, I was enjoying it. I drifted off some. I have a recurring hallucination where it looks like I'm in a jungle and there's like ferns that are sort of above my eyes and there's like stars and stuff beyond them. It may just
feel like you're floating down a river.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the sense of motion at times, I don't know if it ever felt like you were going up or down, but sometimes it did with me
mostly
too.
Mostly forward, you know.
But it's like it feels like you're moving and you're in no way moving. So, yeah, I mean, the hallucinatory qualities, it's an interesting experience. It's not incredibly expensive. You can find one. I highly recommend it.
I don't know, man. I used to have a recurring dream of being eaten by a shark. I blame Jaws the Revenge. So my greatest fear would be getting in this tiny tank and floating in the water and 20 minutes in feeling something graze my leg.
It's just the fires on the mechanical shark showing up.
Yeah, all joking aside, like, I wonder how people might fare in it that suffer from like anxiety attacks. Do you think it would actually be a good thing for them, or do you think that all of that sort of nothingness surrounding them would sort of?
I wouldn't say severe anxiety, but I definitely have anxiety, and in that time that I described, the really positive experience came directly after I sort of started freaking out and forced myself to stay in it so that I could win the battle of like my own mind. Like, I wanted to get out. I was like, why the fuck am I in here? It's like, someone could come in and just like lock this thing or something. There's no lock on it, but like in theory, you know, I could just be trapped in here. What am I doing? You know, why it feels like I'm dead or whatever, all these weird thoughts. And I was like, okay, you're floating in the darkness. You can barely even sense your own body. All you have is your mind. Your mind is making you feel crazy right now. overpower your mind.
The thing is, it's like a foot of water or 2 feet of water. So in terms of like, as soon as you start to have that, you know, all you got to do is put your foot down, you know, put your hand down.
Touch the sides of the tank.
You know, I sort of get that thing too. And I can't swim at night in a pool without the irrational shark fear. But this is sort of less scary than that, because as soon as you start to get that sense, it'll break the illusion, but you could, just boom, touch the bottom and there's no shark in here.
Yeah. So, to me, the rewarding thing was facing my anxiety head on. And I've been told by the people at the facilities that even people with claustrophobia, which is the thing that I think most people, it keeps them away, because, you're locking yourself in a dark box, basically. That even with people with claustrophobia, it can be a way to actually conquer claustrophobia. Mm-hmm. If you're willing to take baby steps and sort of do a little bit at a time, it actually can sort of help. That is what I've been told. I'm not particularly claustrophobic myself. My wife is more, and she's interested in trying it. So
she would do it.
I think she definitely would.
That would be cool. I would very much like to try it, though. It does sound very interesting. Now, I got to ask, having tried that experience, do you at all feel any sort of need to go to Mexico and go on like a mushroom trip?
I mean, I'm fascinated with, here's another connectiveness to Enter the Void. So the drug, they don't specifically list, I think they use fake names in this movie. It's ayahuasca is specifically the drug that they're doing in this when he goes down to Mexico. And it's some kind of like a root that it's some sort of like a fermented thing that they're making with all these. And it's a real thing that like in Enter the Void specifically, it's DMT is the active. If someone's some huge drug expert, correct me if I'm fucking this up, but I'm not.
Here's your first experience with Twitter, getting up your ass about something you spoke on a podcast.
But it's basically the same thing from what I understand it. And so in Enter the Void, he smokes DMT and has this whole trip thing. And in this, you see him drinking ayahuasca and stuff. And I've read a lot about ayahuasca and that, what it does to your brain and what people see. And there's a lot of, look it up. I could just talk for another hour about it. There's a lot of compelling evidence that it's a really more than just you see crazy shit. And I'm not saying I don't have any experience with it, but it would be hard to not be very curious if the opportunity, presented itself. But again, it's like, that's the idea of flying to Mexico and hiking in a mountain to find it's like that obviously is going to be a no-go, because just how do you even get that opportunity? But it's especially when you watch the movie and you think about all the stuff and you read about like the reality, because he's touching on some real stuff with the way these things work and everything. So I don't know. It's very fascinating.
Well, I can say I have no interest. but I'll also say it's a good thing that we didn't choose Crash.
The prep work for that podcast alone would be.
I'm gonna leave that one there. Good one.
So can I ask, before we start wrapping up, you mm-hmm. gentlemen are writers, and in doing research for it, we've already touched on it a bit, that the directors who passed on the project in the wake of, Penn leaving, or perhaps it was Penn who got the job after the other directors were approached, and he left due to the sort of issues he had with Chayefsky. And then ultimately, I think I read somewhere that Ken Russell had Chayefsky banned from the set. Ultimately, I got to ask, as writers, would you ever feel, do you think you would ever find yourselves in the position, or what circumstances would have to happen for you to find yourselves in the position that you would actually want to remove your names from the finished product, much as Chayefsky did with this movie, which is weird because he actually wrote the novel, and that's still, that is very much a part of the movie's making. It's still listed as being based on the novel by Paddy Chayefsky, and yet the screenplay credit is for Sidney Aaron, which is in fact Chayefsky using a pseudonym. So I just wonder if you'd considered that, and what do you ever think something?
If we had an adaptation of anything that we wrote that was as faithful to the book, not even the script, which I have not read the screenplay, but I've read the book. If we had anything that came as close to being actually representing our writing as the movie is to the novel, I would be thrilled. I've been very happy with a lot of how our things turned out, but it's it's super faithful to the point where, like, snatches of dialogue are lines of description from the novel, you know? And it's that's so very rare.
I think he was just, I mean, honestly, he died of cancer, like, I believe shortly after the movie came out or right before it came out. I, you know, it's hard to say. I mean, I've known friends that, you know, had serious illnesses and, you know, when people are under such physical stress, and if you're aware of your own condition, it can, you know, the emotions, it's possible that he just was getting to becoming increasingly impossible due to his own personal issues, and that, sure, like, that he, that had he been in his right mind, he would have been able to see what a fucking phenomenal movie this is. But it's like, but you're right. I mean, it, like, that's, considering what it is, in this case, it's unthinkable. But I think the case that would be the most upsetting for us, and you tell me if you have a different answer, Luke, I think the case that would be the most upsetting is if we wrote something that was changed so drastically, but that somehow we still retained complete credit, which is because the Writers Guild decides credit, and you know, obviously, you know, you could try to take your name off things. I don't know how exactly that works, but. But having credit also ties in with the money made. And I think if we were be in a situation where the Writers Guild determined we got sole credit on a project that was changed so drastically that we felt was not ours anymore, and then it was incredibly successful, I think that particular combination would be the most frustrating thing, where if it was like you know, suddenly the movie's like, you know, grossing $100 million in the box office and everyone loves it.
Getting credit for something that you weren't responsible for.
Yeah, yeah. So, like, going from not liking it and then seeing everyone else like it, I think, like, the dissociative existential problem of, like, does that mean I'm wrong? You know, like, am I a fraud for receiving credit, which was, you know, fairly apportioned to me by the guild? It's just not my opinion. Like, that particular combination, which we have not experienced yet, but that I could see being very frustrating and having the desire to take your name off. But even then, we probably wouldn't, I don't think.
No, I gotta be, there's the business and the politics side of it, but it's ultimately just a real bummer that he couldn't collaborate, you know, or just direct himself, you know?
It's, yeah,
like, it'd be, you know, if you have this much power to wield and you feel that strongly, you know, great. It'd be awesome to sort of work your way to become a director, or, you know, hopefully you find the people that get it and you're speaking the same language and they're additive. You know, the director is adding things and you trust them. And it is sad that he didn't have, you know, any trust in Russell. And I guess it's sort of an arranged marriage. That's the way it goes. But, you know, you kind of wish that he had sort of been able to see his strengths and allow each contributor to play to their strengths instead of trying to dominate.
Because we like working with directors, and we expect our projects to change. I mean, we have high opinions of certain aspects of our scripts, but we've never followed the sort of David Mamet or apparently Padachevsky school, which probably comes from being playwrights. I think it's a commonality there.
Sure.
That, like, both of those guys are famous for kind of seeing their words as, like, this is every comma, every, you know, every hesitation, every beat for beat, this is what you have to say. And I think that with us, it's always been a process of, like, we write it the best we think it can possibly be. We take our writing very seriously. You know, I respect that about people like Padachevsky as well, but we don't. The best version on the page isn't necessarily the best version that's going to work on screen. So we never have been, like, Nazis about, you know, every single word and stuff. And it's like, you show up on set or you stay in touch with the crew or, you know, whatever, and you make sure, you know, you try to make the thing evolve as it goes with all the collaborators, and most particularly the director, but then also the actors. And it's
sure.
Like, this movie works, but my understanding of why Chavsky hated it so much was just that he wanted all of the lines to be very clearly stated and, like, everyone to sort of, like, marvel at the power of his language.
Which
and
is a
Russell
bummer because
made
it's,
them kind of yell at each
it's
other,
very,
which is more real.
But it's very effective, though, in the fact that this is what is essentially, like, sounds like Star Trek jargon, is delivered like a Shakespearean soliloquy in several scenes, and it is given power by the actors performing it.
I think so.
You know, and I sort of, you know, made note of that and was marveling at that. You know, like, at the end of the day, I guess to sum up, this would be, you know, obviously as a screenwriter, there's a part of me that wants to be like, yeah, he was fucking, you know, exerting his power and taking control. You want that vicarious thing, but when you any of the stories. You can't really have any other reaction than, like, man, fuck that guy.
Yeah. Yeah, that
sounds like a nightmare.
You know, maybe he just picked the wrong battles or something. But, I mean, you know, I think I think we all agree it works out and it came made for a very interesting movie. I wish it, you know, hadn't ended in despair for him. And the,
oh,
you know,
100%.
But it's, I think, you know, hopefully anyone who listens to this who hasn't seen the movie is intrigued enough by all the nonsense we've been saying.
Yeah, hopefully we didn't, you know, sound like too, you know, pretentious or talking out of the ass here. But, you know, it's Altered States like that.
Yeah,
if any movie, you know, required that sort of response.
Well, to answer your question as to why we picked it, because apparently we're pretentious and we talk out of our asses like characters in Altered States.
Not at all. Not at all. I've had a blast chatting with you, gentlemen. Can I ask, before we go, do you have any sort of final parting thoughts about Altered States?
I mean, I guess just that I really, you know, I want more people to see it. For a couple of years there, it was a movie that if I brought it up to anyone who was under the age of like 30, they'd never heard of it. And I think that, you know, it's a movie that, like I was just saying, I hope, you know, kind of has a resurgence. And I think there's a lot there that filmmakers now could learn from, and some of the stuff we're talking about, we've been talking about the way it's paced, the way the characters work. I hope it finds a new audience and brings people not just that want to see trippy hallucination stuff, which is why I think most people initially see it, but that sure. It's that the movie has a quality and a greater value as a horror movie and as a science fiction movie and as a romance, that those things together make for a very unique stew that hasn't existed. And
yeah.
That's what excites me.
No, I guess, yeah, it's just sort of in closing, we've talked a lot about theme and ideas and sort of what's interesting. I guess it's a little bit of a bummer that we didn't get to say enough about the filmmaking of it. You know, I want to give a shout out to the amazing, like, one-er, like, single take toward the end when she's delivering that monologue you mentioned earlier, Jinx, about, you know, trying to get him out of her system, and she's talking to Mason, and it's all through the windows of the house, and it's sort of panning across, and we're peeking in through the different windows in this sustained take as she's delivering, you know, and it does feel like a play, and that's very powerful. And then also the effects, of course, we talk about the hallucinatory sequences, and we've mentioned it, but the sheer variety of effects work in this. So even if you're not into the, you know, the gobbledygook and the, you know, the highfalutin stuff or the trippy stuff, it is some of the best practical effects work, and then, you know, some great makeup effects work and all this compositing work, and consistently, you know, it's never really a boring movie. There's always something exciting to look at. And that's another reason why I like it, is that it works on every level. There's sort of the literary level to it, but just on a just if you want to see some crazy effects from the early 80s, you know,
I mean,
it delivers consistently.
I put it up there with, I mean, what are the band with The Thing,
you
know,
The Fly,
American Werewolf. You know, like, I mean, I think it sits along.
But just for sheer variety, yeah, that every trick in the book is sort of employed in it. It's just on that level, even if you know, this guy's an asshole and this story doesn't make any sense to me, and, you know, I don't like how they're treating the children. There's still something there that's like, well, shit, that's pretty rad looking. So, yeah.
All right. Well, I think that's just about our time. Can I ask, where can folks find you at online, and what can we keep an eye out for from you in the future?
So we're both on Twitter. I don't remember how.
I'm at Luke. At @Luke_Piotrowski, which is kind of hard to spell. It's Piotrowski, but I'm sure if you just find Ben Collins, you can find me.
Yeah, I think I'm like, what am I? I'm like @B. Davis Collins, I think. Davis Collins, yeah. And our movie Siren, you can rent it or buy it on iTunes and Amazon, or plays on the Chiller Network. There they produced the movie.
Yeah, but I mean, the Chiller Network version is going to cut out some of the good stuff. I would recommend just, you know, streaming it on Amazon or Redboxing it if it's still there.
Yeah, and then somewhere in the fall, September, October, as you mentioned at the top, things are our movie Super Dark Times is going to be released in a limited theatrical format.
It's a coming of age thriller premiered at Tribeca, and we're very proud of it. We're proud of Siren as well, and I wish more people would see that one, because that's a very fun throwback movie. But they're very different movies. And then we have one called Underground that's filming, I think, in August, September.
Yeah.
With Luc Besson's company, Europacorps, and that should be pretty fun and gnarly. Comparable to Seven, I guess.
Yeah, in
some ways. But crazier.
Yeah, there's some crazy shit in that one.
Pulpier.
So there's other ones in the pipeline, and you know, hopefully, you know, movies and TV shows and lots of things. But yeah, we're on Twitter. We're accessible and friendly for the most part. Sometimes. I don't know. All we're right. Probably, like we are on this all the time. So like this, whatever that is. But yeah, say hi if you feel like it, anyone.
All right. Well, thank you again so much. I had a blast chatting with you, and thanks so much for choosing this movie. You're right. I think it's a movie that needs a little bit of light shown on it. So hopefully people will listen to this and decide to check it out immediately.
Thank you so much for having us on. This has been a blast. We'll do it again sometimes.
All right. And thanks all you listeners out there. As always, make certain to like, subscribe, share, rate and review us on iTunes. Yell at us on Facebook and Twitter. We are at Scream Addicts, and I am at Jinx1981. Until next time, folks, thanks so much and have a great weekend.
I'm a professor of endocrinology at the Harvard Medical School. I'm an attending physician at the Peter Bent Brigham Hospital. I'm a contributing editor to the American Journal of Endocrinology. And I'm a fellow and vice president of the Eastern Association of Endocrinologists and president of the Journal Club. And I'm not going to listen to any more of your capitalistic, quantum, friggin' dumb, limbo, mumbo-jumbo. I'm going to show these to a radiologist.